Welcome to Why I'll Never Make It, a lighthearted podcast that takes a revealing look at a career in the entertainment industry, featuring stories and conversations with those on stage and backstage, on screen and behind the scenes. To keep up with all the guests and episodes, go to the website, winmepodcast.com. There you will find ways to follow and connect via Twitter and Instagram, as well as ways to support and donate to this podcast. I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, and this is Why I'll Never Make It. Well, here we are, the final episode of Season 2. This has been quite a journey here for Season 2. Thank you so much for joining me on all these episodes. And we've had some great guests along the way, starting off with Wojcik and Sea Casting, along with a Tony nominee, Caitlin Kennan. But we've also featured people in the writing world, like John McNally and another John McGinty. There are just so many guests that I am so grateful for that they came on the show. And today is no exception to that. Mr. Ben Davis is actually someone that I discovered. He did a BBC Royal Albert Hall production of Kiss Me, Kate. It was a one night only. That stage version was filmed and presented on BBC back in 2014. And that was actually what introduced me to Ben Davis. I had not seen his work up until then. And when you hear a great baritone, as you know, as I am a baritone myself, I always kind of look up to and I'm always anxious to hear another great baritone, because tenor, especially pop tenor, tends to be where the Broadway musical is nowadays. And to hear such a great voice as his is quite a treat. In fact, it was the Hollywood Reporter that was giving a review and called it Davis's seductive baritone is swoon-worthy, which I think is an apt description of his voice. And once I discovered that Kiss Me, Kate version, I then started looking up other work that he's done. And it basically is a list of all my shows that I would love to do. So in the episode today, we talk about some of the shows that he's had a chance to do and some of the directors that he's had a chance to work with. And for me, I know you're going to get a lot out of this, but for me, it really was kind of a research and a case study of what, hopefully, fingers crossed, my career can be. But for now, here is Ben Davis. I join him at the Muni. Currently, I'm in Kinky Boots, and he was in the show right before us, Guys and Dolls, playing the part of Sky Masterson, of course, yet another of my bucket list roles. And so I caught up with him at the Muni last week. All right, Ben, here we are. We're in your dressing room at the Muni.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Now you have been the Muni several times before.
Yeah, this is my fifth show here. I love it. Any time I can come back, I do.
St. Louis itself is a good place.
And it is.
And the Muni is very welcoming. I mean, but it's a quick process.
It's a really quick process. But what I like about that is that you have to kind of force yourself to make a decision and make a choice and go with it. There's not a lot of time to overthink it. There's no time to overthink it, which is kind of a nice thing.
Yeah. Now, with the shows that you've done, were any of them shows you've done before, or were you coming in new to each of them?
My first show here was Spamalot, and I'd done that for 2 years previous to that. So, but the choreography was completely different, which always stresses me out.
That's my nemesis.
Yeah. So that was the part of it. It was Dennis Jones who choreographed it, who's fantastic. He directed and choreographed it. But it was not the walk in the park I thought it was going to be. So, that's the only show I've done before that.
Yeah, and so coming here, then you do a lot of your own prep before getting here.
Yeah, you just try to bone up on the lyrics and on the words, the scenes as much as possible, because you don't want to stress out. You want to be able to play, and it also makes it you're being a good team player if you do that, because then you can really play with your scene partners a lot more.
Right, so you're not buried in your script
exactly,
during the scene work.
Exactly.
Yeah. What is your process like for preparing, learning lines, getting the music up?
Just, you know, if I'm playing something from something or something where I can reference it, I'll watch that. But I'll always just kind of go with what's in the script itself. Sometimes you can get buried in research a little much, and that feeds a backstory, but you still got to deal with what's on the sheet, on the paper there. So I'll do that for memorization. Writing helps me a lot. Just writing it down. There's something tactile about that.
Is that for both lines and the music?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I'll go over it with my girlfriend a lot. She's a fantastic judge of me and is liberal with her opinion, which I love. So that helps a lot, especially with movement, because she's a dancer. So and I'm not. So she's good at physicality, so she helps me with that.
Yeah.
And kind of sometimes matching physicality to words does a lot. So that's the kind of the final thing, is that
right. You
get up as much as you can, and then without cementing an idea in your head, and then you get it up on its feet, and it kind of that helps you.
Yeah, because there are those physical anchors that's like, oh, right, I'm moving here, or I'm doing this gesture, and that kind of reminds you where you are.
Exactly.
Line-wise. Yeah. So with your, you know, since we share our love of dance.
Yes.
Have you felt that has held you back any as you've gone through your career, or has it affected that in any way?
Maybe, but I don't know. I mean, we all have what we do, and you try to make the most of within that. And I'm just not going to be a dancer, and was never going to be a dancer. And so I've been able to do some dancey stuff. We did Oklahoma here 3 years ago, something like that, 3 or 4 years ago. And they did the Stroman version where I was playing curly and I had to do the ballet myself.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
And I had to learn that in like 4 or 5 days. Luckily, Christine Cornish-Smith was my Laurie, and she's an incredible Trina and actress and singer. And she helped me a great deal. And we had amazing people helping us learn it. So
yeah, because it's not just about being in the right place, right time. You have to like actually look like you're exuding it and enjoying it and expressing your.
Yeah, I'm not sure I captured that 100%, but I think we got pretty close.
Yeah. So you have done a lot of, I guess, what would be called classical music. Would you say that that's like your genre? That's what you do best?
It seems to fit my voice best, only because I am a legit baritone. Like, you know, I used to sing high A's all the time when I first joined Les Mis, but I don't want to do that. That doesn't allow for any kind of life outside of this.
Right, right.
You can't, I mean, if you pay me a lot, we can get there. But yeah. So they just don't write modern music, contemporary musicals for baritones anymore. Not very many, at least. So I found myself being employable mostly in those golden age musicals.
Yeah. Do you enjoy that most? Have you tried to like push yourself and be in more contemporary stuff, or does it just kind of, that's how it falls?
I mean, that's how it falls. I've been going in and out of Dear Evan Hansen, standing by for the father, for Larry. And that's been great. And I love that music. And the show is fantastic. But, you know, you just kind of do the best you can, and then – to a certain extent, the business, I feel like, dictates where you're going to go. You can't control that part of it. All you can do is kind of prep yourself the best way possible so that you have as many tools in your box. And then the market kind of dictates for you where you're going to lay.
That's true, because we have our own ideas of what our type is. But then, as you say, the casting directors, producers, the things we're cast in kind of make that decision for us.
And you know, that can be frustrating because we all like to think that we're much more malleable than maybe we in fact are.
I can do all things.
I can do everything. But at the same point in time, if you find something that people seem to think you're good at, make the most of it and try to, and you know, especially as I've gotten older, it's become, I'm starting to fill that niche now a little more and more. And so it's nice. I was never the pretty boy ingenue. So I've kind of grown into myself a little bit. Hopefully I have a couple more years of that at least before
right.
I just go.
Right, a few more years left.
Oh, God. Yeah.
So how was that, I guess, finding yourself, finding your type?
Yeah.
How did you go about kind of, I guess, fitting into what those casting directors were finding you for? And because you said it can be a frustrating process sometimes.
Yeah, well, it's just about, I think I was lucky because my first show, big show, was Les Mis, which was a singer show.
Mm-hmm.
And then my second show was La Boheme on Broadway, which was
another
singer show. So that kind of fit that. So people knew that I could do that. And then my next show was Thoroughly Modern Millie, which was incredibly frightening and scary, but awesome experience because I got to do a comedic role. So that kind of broke that stereotype. So you just try to chip away at whatever walls they try to put you in and you know, expand what you can do and fail a lot and see what happens. But that was just not being scared of trying and putting yourself out there, I think, is the best advice that I could give.
Yeah. And for Love O.M., there was a special Tony Award given just for that ensemble cast.
Yeah.
Explain exactly what they or how they gave that award out to your ensemble.
So my role, Marcello the baritone, was double cast. So I had another guy that played the role four times. I would play four times a week. And then Musetta, who was our female counterpart, was also double cast. The Rodolfos and Mimis were triple cast, the tenor and other soprano. So the producers and Baz didn't want everybody pitted against each other. It would have been hard to do.
You had to figure out who's featured leading.
Exactly. So they petitioned the Tony committee not to do that. And the Tony committee said they wanted to honor us. So they decided for this honor for excellence in theater. And it's a gorgeous award. Hugh Jackman gave it to us. I feel incredibly blessed to have it. And that experience of La Boheme will always be, not because of the Tony, in part because of that recognition, but just the whole experience in general was really, truly special.
Because La Boheme is a much different show from most musical theater.
Yeah, it is. But if I can say any of the operas that would be accessible, it is that. It was Baz and CM, his wife. Their aesthetic and their way of working is just, it's unlike almost anything I've ever done. It was just so gorgeous.
Well, I mean, Moulin Rouge is one of my all-time favorite movies. And that was just a couple of years after that
right
had
after,
come out.
Yeah.
So what was it like? Because did you see Moulin Rouge?
I loved it.
Right. So you knew about his work even before then. And so what was that process like? Going, because that was a film.
Yeah.
This is now going to be on stage.
He directed everything very cinematically.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Even the audition process was so interesting. Everything was filmed. He was up with you with a camera in your face the whole time as you're auditioning.
Wow.
Yeah, it was so cool. But it took it out because we all most sane people hate auditions. But the second it turns into a work session or something that doesn't feel like you're having to put out product, but that you're working. And that's what he did, even just in being up with you. You felt like he was up there with you and kind of like he would take you over in the corner and whisper something to you and then have you come back and film you again. And so it was just so cool. It's like one of those things where he's one of those directors, and the good ones are like this, I think, that he makes you think you come to your choices on your own.
And it's only he's really steering.
Yeah, it's only when you look back and you're like, oh, no, he totally was taking me there.
Yeah.
So, but he makes you feel empowered.
Yeah, well, and that's so important because we were talking about this, I guess, lack of control about finding our own type sometimes.
Yeah.
And so it's great whenever we can have those moments where it's a little bit more in our control.
Yeah.
Have you worked on stuff that's your own or things that you've created or produced yourself?
I'm
to take back some of that
so,
control.
So upset with myself that I haven't, and I've been meaning to. You know, I never thought that I had. Honestly, I just didn't think I had much of a story to tell or anything like that because I led a pretty, you know, kind of blessed life and hashtag blessed and blessed life. And then I saw my friend Ed Hibbert do a cabaret and it was fantastic. And then my friend Marin did one about her growing up and listening to records. It was fantastic. And I loved what they said. And this was after my father passed away and I got divorced. So I was like, okay, now I have some shit that I can.
Right.
Sorry. Now I have some stuff that I can lay out there. I have some life experience, some stuff that wasn't so rosy happened. So maybe I just need to order it and figure out what songs are going to go and see if it's something worth doing. But that being said, then I just helped. I did an encore show with Karma Cusack.
She's wonderful.
She's
isn't she?
Unbelievable.
Yeah. She and I did First Wives Club together. And she's just a lovely person.
She is.
Besides being extra talented.
Yeah. Exceedingly talented.
Yeah.
And then after we got done with Call Me Madam, she went and did a couple concerts or a concert at 54 Below.
Mm-hmm.
And she asked me to sing at it and a couple other people. And it was just stuff that she liked. Had no story or anything. It was like, oh, I just love these songs. I want to sing them.
Yeah.
And that's like... I wish I could do that. I wish I had the balls to be like, people want to hear me do this.
Right.
So I do. That's the long answer to the short answer of, no, I've been lazy and I need to do it.
But you want
lazy
to do
sky.
It.
Yeah, I do. I really do.
Yeah. So when it comes to the kind of roles that that you've wanted to do? Are there any that are kind of outstanding, those bucket lists? It's like, I haven't quite made those yet.
I want to do Sweeney Todd at some point. Yeah.
Well, that's a beast.
It is a beast. And it's, there have been possibilities that have come about, but then didn't come about. So that's fine. And we'll wait for it to happen in the right way.
Yeah.
So that's one. I just want to see what people can do that's new. I would love to play Don Quixote, but I don't know if that'll ever happen.
I've gotten to do it once. But with the way casting's going.
It's interesting. You
know, yeah.
So there are those, but I really want someone to write a musical theater role for a legit baritone again.
Right. Right.
It's, I think it's a voice, not just a Fock, but a voice type that's missing. I did this thing called, Baritones Unbound, which was written by Mark Kudish and about the history of the baritone voice. And it was me and
that
Kudish.
Sounds exactly like something Kudish would talk about. I've seen his videos where he kind of goes off about musicals and
he's
what
brilliant.
The voice should do.
Yeah. He's, I mean, Kudish is a very, very well-run and intelligent individual. And so this was about the history of the baritone voice and where it kind of abruptly stops, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And but the thing is the baritone voice was always the voice of the people. It was kind of like the everyday man's voice. I think that it's a storyteller's voice because it's in a normal range. You know what I mean? The ear can hear it very easily.
Yeah, it's generally not a very showy part.
No,
because of that.
Yeah. And I think that's missing because you can get real characters. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? They can. So that's what I hope. I hope somebody comes along that has a great deal of skill and love of storytelling that wants to do that. What's on Broadway and some of the music on Broadway is fantastic right now. But I really do miss some storytelling.
Yeah.
And not just fireworks.
Yeah, because the show that I'm doing here at Muni, Kinky Boots, you know, it has the baritone line, and I'm just doing G's and A's.
That's incredible. That's incredible.
Right? I'm like, yes, as a baritone, I can go up there, but I like to come back down.
Yes, please.
So we can,
right?
So I can make it through the whole show.
Yeah. You just, So, and I think that there's, plus, yeah, anyways.
Well, in this cabaret, so you can do all those songs that touch a G and come
and
back
then
down.
Come back down to earth.
To normal land.
Yes, exactly. That's where I'd like to live.
So it's very interesting as I was looking back on all the stuff you've done, because I was first introduced to you through the Kiss Me Kate,
The
BBC production, which was just fantastic.
That was
fun. For me, that's one of my bucket list roles to do Fred, which is so great. And so it was interesting as I was going through your resume, and really you're my first guest who's like, either done roles that I've done or you're hitting the bucket list roles that I still have.
Yeah.
And so to talk to you as baritone to baritone, as we've been doing, what have you found has been the, I don't want to say secret, but basically your motivation and what has kept you going in, you know, because obviously there have been moments where you haven't been cast in something.
Yeah.
And what has kept you going to push on into those roles?
It's interesting because especially with the baritone voice, I feel like they'll sacrifice the voice in our roles. Because you don't have to have somebody who can hit A's and B flats and stuff like that, so you'll pull a tenor into a baritone role where you can't put a baritone into a tenor role if that tenor has star power, if they have, you know what I mean?
I get that. Yeah.
So I think you've got to kind of be pissed about that for about 24, 48, 72 hours, and then get over yourself and kind of just go, well, we'll always work. We'll work. It may not always be the work that we want, where we want it, but we'll work. And then the right things will come around and they'll be very special because not a lot of people can do what our voices do in the way that they do them.
Mm-hmm.
So you just kind of got to keep holding on and making your money where you can elsewise, you know, like I'll have to go and do more regional gigs because they do more classics there.
Right, like Muni.
Yeah. Like the Muni. And you just find your work in Ron Raines. I just did Lady in the Dark.
Right.
and with Ron Raines, which was a thrill, another baritone. Mm-hmm. And he's like, just keep on doing what you do. That's all you can do. Just keep on keeping on. And so here we are.
Right, right. It's almost just a career of persistence.
It is. And you know what? I've been fortunate lately to get more and more concert work.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic. It's so exciting to sing with orchestras. The money is usually pretty good, and the time commitment isn't huge. So yeah, you just cobbled it. You know, it is, you're a squirrel trying to get a nut. You just cobble together a career in any way you can.
Yeah.
And, you know, do things like you're doing and find your passions and your interests in any way you can and follow that.
And what do you do to maintain your voice? Because especially as you start to do concerts more, then it's really about the voice and not necessarily telling
the
story.
Yeah, that's so stressful. You know, I had horrible reflux. This was about 12 years ago is when it started. Yeah, 13 years ago. Huh? 13, 14 years ago. And had a granuloma on my arytenoids, which are the cartilage in the back of your throat.
Ooh.
And so I lost range. I lost dynamics. It was awful. And I went and had throat surgery from Dr. Zeitel's up in Boston, who did Adele's surgery and everything.
Oh, okay.
And was on vocal silence for 3 weeks, and it grew back to its original size. So they're like, okay, well, this isn't vocal abuse. This must be reflux. I found out I had Barrett's esophagus, which is a precancerous condition in your esophagus.
Oh, my gosh.
So then I had to have stomach surgery for the reflux and another throat surgery. And that made
me
so
acutely. Your body was just fighting against you. Yeah.
Yeah. And my dad passed away 6 years ago from esophageal cancer. So it was a good thing that I'm a singer and that it affected me that much so I could get it taken care of.
Yeah.
But as you get through your career, you become more and more acutely aware of your voice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a blessing and a curse because you know when you're even feeling slightly off and you know you can get through it and everything like that. But the older you get too, rarely are the days that you're like, oh man, I'm 100%.
What is 100%?
It is just all there. Remember when you were, I got cast in Les Mis when I was 22 years old. It didn't matter. I was singing A's, H shows. I could have wide open A's. Yeah. Like just didn't matter.
Yeah.
No way, man. No. So it's just... But so you just kind of pick your repertoire and the programming. You work with the person you're doing the concert with to program it correctly. And try not to drink as much alcohol as you want to.
I've discovered that myself. Yeah,
it's no fun.
I have to lay off the alcohol.
It's no fun, but it beats having to stress out about your voice.
Now, did you find this because in my 20s, when I was, early 20s going to college, that was really my first vocal training of any kind.
Mine too, yeah.
And so... that was about an E. Maybe I could tweak out an F if I was like on a good day. But then as I've gotten older, now I can get up to a flat.
Yeah.
So have you found that your vocal range has expanded and shifted as you've gotten older?
Definitely. Because I started late and my senior year, so my first show ever was my junior year in high school. It was West Side Story. I played riff, the most non-dancing riff ever. This is going to sound awful. This was back in the day. My senior year, we did King and I. I was Loon Ta.
I was Pepe in West Side Story. So,
that would never happen.
Well, but when I'm from Alabama, so
Indiana.
I knew not one Hispanic person growing up.
Yeah, we had a couple of Asian people. That was it.
Yeah.
So I had to hit a G in there, and I was freaking out.
Oh, yeah.
We got through it somehow. My first voice teacher was Ben Wright's mother, who was Jack in Into the Woods, the original Jack in Into the Woods.
Okay.
She was fantastic, so she helped me a great deal. My final audition for Les Mis was on the phone. So, because...
I've never had one of those.
They flew me... I auditioned in Chicago. They flew me to New York for a second one. I was still in Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was sitting at work, and they called me, and they're like, we didn't check to see how high you could sing. We're going to put you on the phone with the music director.
Oh, and just do the scales?
Sing the phrase.
Oh,
and it was,
okay.
We'll be there. And I was like, okay. And I'd never hit an A in my life, ever. So I go home and I'm like, like screaming him out. And he played it and I hit it twice. Youth. And
muscle
through it. And 2 weeks later, I was on the road with Les Mis.
Yeah.
So, but my voice is actually rounded out a lot and so A flat is as high as I want to go now, and I can do, like, I've sung Bring Him Home and stuff like that. But I just don't want to have to do 8 shows a week of worrying about that.
Because when you started Les Mis, that was Ange Ross?
I was Feuilly first.
Okay.
But then I played Ange Ross on Broadway and on tour as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Ange Ross, I've done that role twice regionally. Yeah.
It's a bitch of a role.
It's
screaming and it's...
Yeah. Yeah. There's that one song where literally the entire page, you're just sitting on a G.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That G sharp.
Yep.
You know, that you're just like...
Yeah. No, it's ridiculous. They didn't write kindly for the voice.
Again, taking the baritone
all the way
stratosphere.
Up. Yeah. So that was...
But still, Les Mis, I'm sure you would agree. It's just one of my favorite scores.
I did it for 4 years. I mean, yeah. I did it for a long time. Yeah.
So you got to know
score. Loved it. So I found my voice has rounded out and gained... Sometimes I listen back to my voice in and I miss the kind of like ping and everything. But then I'm very satisfied with what my voice is now because I think it's different than what is on Broadway. And so you got to love what you can do and not.
Right, right. You can only be where you are.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And so at this point, would you say that you have made it? Does it feel like you have made it?
Man, I'll be very honest with you. No, I was just sitting back at the hotel room. Having you know, every now and then you have moments of satisfaction. Then every now and then you have these freak out moments like, God, what is going on? And look, I'm very, very happy with my career and what I've done. I'm very proud of it. But there's still like you can have a great deal of moments of inadequacy and of fear and like, what am I going to do and where's it going to go? And then you let that feeling come and you let it go and you just keep moving on. So it's a moment to moment thing. Mm-hmm. You just kind of go with it.
What's the longest stretch that you had between jobs, between bookings?
It was when I took La Boheme to LA and then stayed out there thinking I was going to be a TV star. And so I went at least like a year without work, and then I would do a little gig like at Pasadena Playhouse, and then I had a little flurry where I did a couple things at Hollywood Bowl, and then nothing else. And so I actually then, for the first time, and this is going to sound ridiculous, had to get a real world job. And I've been very, very lucky, knock on wood, 21 years now as a professional actor at this level, and had to do that. And it's a hard thing to do, and it's a hard thing for any of us to do, I think. Yeah. To feel like, but it's not giving up and it's not being second best. It's just doing what you got to do in this crazy, crazy, non-linear career.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever thought about giving it up? Was there ever a moment, you know, when that voice came and you're like, maybe I could do something else or should do something else?
I'm sure there have been. I think I probably just blocked it out necessarily.
Yeah.
No, I've always had, and even I was married for 12 years, and my ex-wife didn't work, and so I was the lone breadwinner. So there was a kind of a drive, like to go, okay, I got to do this. And now I'm at a certain point where I'm like I said to you, I'll work. It might not be always the work that I want, and I'll have to hustle, but I'll work.
Yeah.
And
one way or the other.
One way or the other.
Yeah.
So I do have as of yet, unshakable faith, even though I have those moments of doubt, there's a through line of faith that I will work. It just won't always be where I want it to be. It won't always be in New York, and it won't always be exactly what I want.
Would you say that really then is your definition of making it, just being employed, working?
Yeah, you know, when you talk about making it, my idea of making it is to know that I have like 4 months of work and then I have a month off and then I have 3 months of work after that. And then another 2 months off because I want to go piss off. I want to live. I want to live. Right. That's all I want to do. I love this work and it fills my soul and my heart and my mind and everything. It is the energy behind it. But I have an incredible life outside of this. And so I want to explore that life and I just want to enjoy my friends, my family, my loved ones and this world because, you know, my dad dying 6 years ago kind of redefined the way I wanted to live my life. And all I want to do is experience things now and take these memories and not waste that time, you know, because we in this business and in life, we either have the time but not the money or the money but not the time. And money is renewable. You money comes and goes, right? Time does not. Time is gone. So I just don't want to waste time, and I just want to try to experience everything I can.
What is it that fills your soul? You know, as you were saying, performing as we all know is a great high and a great experience. But what is it that would you say truly motivates you throughout your daily life?
Just being happy, honestly, like trying to find perspective. I have perspective tattooed on me. I have now tattooed on me. So all these little reminders to myself. Yeah. Of just like what's important. And like anytime I start getting down about myself, I try to tell myself to pull back and view things from a macro lens instead of a micro lens, and to know that this moment will pass. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the good times will never last and the bad times will never last. So don't get so hung up on the bad times and learn to really enjoy the good times. I don't know. I'm going to sound like a self-help book right now, but it's just really important to me because the vagrancies of this career can really, really envelop you and take you under.
Yeah. Well, I was reading, and this was a recent actual study, like a scientific study. They went through IBDB and just kind of did this survey of like several thousand actors and actresses. And they were saying that I think it was like 70 or 80% of them are gone after a year. So like they go, they try to, they work, they do this and that for a year, and then you never hear from them again. They're out of the business or doing other things. And so I think it is all about staying power and somehow finding that, okay, I haven't worked in this long, but I'm going to keep going.
Yeah.
And finding that.
You know, it's so interesting. Robin Herder. Do you know Robin?
I don't know.
So she's I think Nina's the character in Moulin Rouge. She's like the dancer character, what was her name? Caroline O'Connor role.
Oh, right. Yes. That role. Yes.
And Robin, to me, we did Kiss Me, Kate. I had done Oklahoma with Clyde, her husband, Clyde House, here. But then we did Kiss Me, Kate, she and I and him in Seattle. And I think she's spectacular. She's like a star. She is unreal. And she went 3 years, I think she said, without working.
Like nothing?
Nothing. And she had a kid for one of those, but still. And so, you know, there's just no rhyme or reason to it. All I can ask myself is, am I getting in my own way? Because most people, why is that person not working? They're so spectacularly talented. And there are always different reasons, but the majority of the time, it's because they're getting in their own way. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm in a place of where I'm not doing something, or if I'm not booking, or if I'm not, all I can do is ask, am I getting in my own way?
Right. Is there something that I need to adjust or tweak?
Am I not preparing well enough? Am I going in with an attitude that I don't want to? Am I not putting myself out there in the way that I want to?
Is there a certain thing that you've seen in your own work or your own preparing that where you're like, oh, this is what's holding me back?
I think I used to think that a sort of improvisational quality or sort of fresh quality would be refreshing in an audition and not to be constricted by having too many ideas going in. And the more and more I've gotten into this, I'm like, no, you need to have like an absolute blueprint as to how you want this audition to go, because it's a work session for you. So when you go into an audition, you take control as much as you can without being like bossy in the audition. Yeah. Take control of that time as much as you can. And the only way you can do that is through preparation beforehand. So, and I'm not always good about following this. That's one of the things I was getting on myself about sitting in my hotel room before I came here, was opportunities that have passed because of my lack of preparedness.
Yeah. 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 We were talking about cabarets, and there was one earlier this year where the composer sent me the music, and just like, you know, I was busy doing this or that, and two weeks went by and I was like, oh, right, I need to. And then the moment had gone. So she found other people for her cabaret. So it's just, it's stuff like that where, it's a matter of focus and figuring out what's important, prioritizing your time. Yeah. Again, back to the time.
Yeah.
It's so important.
Because it goes. Mm-hmm. you know, and then all you're left with is regret as to like, oh, why I didn't, wasn't, what was I doing? I was doing nothing. Why didn't I just sit down and learn this? Or when you're in that audition and you're nervous because you know you haven't done all the work you needed to do, it's so frustrating.
Yeah.
So why don't we just take the easy road? It's really the easy road by doing the work.
Yeah.
It's not that much. In the end, it's not that hard.
It's generally a 5-10 minute audition.
Yeah.
And that's all we have to prepare for.
Yes.
5 or 10 minutes.
So if you spend, you know, 3 hours, that's nothing. I get so mad at myself. Sorry. I get mm-hmm. so mad at myself when I don't.
I'm the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's not worth it. So that's what I'm saying.
but obviously most of the time you find yourself having prepared and, you know, and so for you, what has been your most favorite role? Not even your most biggest recognition, but your favorite role that like, okay, if I could do this role or this type of show for the rest of my career, this is what I would love to do.
I mean, I go back to the Bohème for a couple of reasons. One, I only had to do 4 shows a week, so my voice always felt fresh.
Oh,
so that was nice to go into a show knowing you had your facilities about you. And it was just gorgeous to be able to sing on Broadway an opera with that orchestra, which was it wasn't full-size orchestra, but it was the largest orchestra on Broadway, and to hear that music and to be a part of something so special and unique. That's where it's gratifying to me is like just being a part of a group, and that's what's special is the connection with people. This Lady in the Dark that we just did was such a special event. It's like a 120-piece chorus. And all of these amazing actors, David Patou, Victoria Clark, Ron Raines, Chris Invar, Montego, Ashley Park, like all these amazing people.
Yeah, and that's a great cast.
That's all you want to do is work with people who are much, much better than you so that you can learn. That's all I want to do. And I'm not trying to sound precious or anything like that, but that's what I get off on is just like learning. And you know, there's a bit of an ego boost saying, yeah, I'm in this group of people. But then you're paddling under the water to try to keep up.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because moving to New York, my big goal was Broadway.
Yeah.
And as that hasn't happened yet, I've had to adjust and you kind of figure out, okay, well, what's really important?
Like,
yes, attaining that level is certainly a nice pinnacle, nice recognition, but I've had to figure out really why I'm doing this. If I'm not going to get that, because who knows, then why else am I here? And so working on great material with great people has kind of become my main goal, wherever that's going to be, regionally, professionally.
That's really the name of the game, man, because there are only so many shows on Broadway at a certain time and only so many then roles that you would be right for. And then there are, you know, how many people, and you're fighting against people who've been involved with that director before or have a star power behind them or whatever it is. There are just so many variables that are out there that it's no reflection on your talent or your ability. It's just timing and luck and your preparation, meeting all of this. I mean, it's just, I don't know. So you can't, obviously there was an article in the Times a couple of months ago about doing things for passion, and when you're doing something that you're passionate about, but it has a goal attached to it, and it robs you, that goal then robs you of your passion. It's a very interesting article.
Because the reaching the goal kind of makes the passion worth it or not. And
yeah, exactly.
That becomes the...
Yeah. And so if you're, you know, instead of the practice of it in itself being that expression of that passion, you've attached it to this ultimate goal.
Because that passion is only worth it if you reach
that end. Yeah, and I don't know that should be the way it is.
That's true.
So it was a very interesting article. And it's interesting. My girlfriend is a little bit younger than me. And so we're at very different points in our career. And it's, you know, without trying to seem like wise old man and everything, and it's just exactly what I don't want to do. But it's just interesting perspective again. And you can't really, and so when she gets down, I'm just like, Paige, you just gotta, you know, just push through, keep going, keep walking it, and it'll happen when it's supposed to happen. And that sounds so cliche, and that's the last thing you want to hear from somebody.
I know. Yeah, because when you're in the midst of that, it's like, Because they look at you. Well, of course you're making it. You're doing it. Yeah. I mean, you're about to go do these three shows, and I'm just waiting to get a reading.
Yeah.
You know. So I get that because my husband's a few years younger as well, and at different points.
Yeah.
And so it's
but it's no less valid. I mean, everybody's in the same place at different levels. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Because I know exactly whenever he you know rails about this or that or is frustrated, I know exactly how he feels. Because last week I felt the same way.
Absolutely.
So it's something that I absolutely identify with.
Yeah.
Because I don't think that frustration goes away.
I don't think I mean, I don't know this, but I would think that no matter what level you're at, you're always there's a dissatisfaction or a fear or whatever there is that this is all there is. Mm-hmm. And it's a fleeting thing. So you got to find the passion in it. And like you said, try to create your own work, which is going to haunt me now. But I need to really get on that.
I've now planted the bug.
Yeah, been there. It's ridiculous. I just got to do it. But again, it's about, my insecurity is that, who's going to want to come see that? Who am I? I mean, everybody does a show at 54 Below. I'm not going to matter in the grand scheme of things there. So it's,
Well, I would be on the front row.
I appreciate that.
I've certainly enjoyed what I've seen.
Thank you. Well, it's, you know what? I just feel so lucky. I feel so lucky to have any sort of career because there are, as you know, you go to these auditions and you hear people sing. You do it and you're like, oh my God, the amount of talent out there. And now you can't even, if I was a kid these days trying to do this, there's no way. Because you have to sing, dance, act, and play an instrument. And
The playing of the instrument. Yeah, it's like,
what the hell?
Yeah. I'm sure eventually they'll do a Guys and Dolls where you have to bring on your own
saxophone. Yeah, no.
Well, you do play a drum at one point.
I do play a drum. I play a mean bass drum. Sometimes I get so excited by it that I forget what my line is when I come out because it's just fun to beat a big drum.
Right. Yeah.
So, but no, it's, I just feel very, incredibly lucky that I've been able to cobble together the career that I have.
Yeah. What do you see going forward that you would like to do more of? Or
it's got to be TV. It's got to be TV and film. Honestly, the way that I see things going is that you can't, it's very difficult to have roles on Broadway without some sort of TV cue, some sort of, you know, wattage behind you. And I want to do theater. So I got to do some TV too. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
Like I always want to be able to come and do some things and I want to do some of the things that I know I'm right for, but I can't command that. And I can't demand that of anybody because I'm not a marketable, you know, quantity. I'm not there where I can ask people to take that leap with me. So I need to do some work and figure out that whole TV film.
Yeah, and that's really become so important, I would say, over the last 5 years. It's like, before it was like stage work would kind of lead you into maybe a TV film career. Now it's the other way around to really, really make it.
Yeah, I mean, I get it. Audiences want identifiable people up on stage. I can bemoan it all I want, but you know, when you're paying $200 for a ticket, $170 for a ticket,
you want it to be worth it.
Yeah. And whether it's true or not, you have a sort of faith in that this person's going to be of a certain level because you've seen them on TV or you just want to see them in real life.
Yeah.
And bridge that gap.
Yeah. I mean, because like there's shows like Wicked that were great shows, but they also have these star cast, Idina Menzel and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But then there are shows, fortunately, that are coming along, like a Hades Town that, you know, won all the awards.
Totally.
That doesn't have that kind of national star power,
right,
but is still going to be something that people want to see and it's selling out. And,
absolutely.
And so it's an interesting, I think.
It becomes an event.
Because I think Broadway is trying to find that balance of the Mean Girls and the King Kongs of the world mixed with a Hades Town and you know the smaller shows that can be like Band's Visit last year that can be so much like having.
I mean, that's always a struggle, commercial versus art, and how do you bridge the two and make them make a commercial show worthy of the art form and make a art form commercially viable.
Yeah,
I mean that's the great puzzle that producers are always trying to put together.
Yeah. Because do you see yourself both as businessman and artist and trying to mesh those two?
Yeah, right. Because we are our own product and that's all we have. So, yeah. So you're always trying to figure out how to market yourself and how to put yourself out there and without being annoying about it.
How did you get into the position of being or auditioning for that BBC Kiss Me Kate?
That was this guy named Larry Moore, who is an amazing arranger and stuff like that. He's been around for a long time. And there was this guy named John McGlynn, who used to do all these old recordings of shows, like big recordings of Showboat and everything. Okay. And he took over that estate for a while. And then it was John Wilson, who has his amazing orchestra in London, was saying, we need a legit baritone and we can't find it here. Do you have anybody over there? And thank God for Larry. He said, yes. Ben. And so I had to put myself on tape for the BBC and got it through him.
Yeah. So it was just a one self tape or did you have
one self tape?
Wow.
Yeah.
One and done. Those are nice.
It was fantastic. It was also scary because it was a one performance.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And it was recorded live. It was broadcast live on BBC Three Radio or BBC Radio.
So
and
you
then
only had one night of that. It wasn't night, like they compiled.
No. Frightening.
Yeah. So whatever happens is posterity for decades to come.
Because they broadcast it live on radio and then they filmed it and broadcast it at Christmas on TV. Mm-hmm. So it was, wow, yeah. That was so much fun, though. That was great.
I mean, it looked like a great time. Was it a mix of English and American and other people?
Yeah, it was Tony Yazbek, Alexandra Silber, and myself were the three Americans. Louise Dearman was the British gal who played Lois. Okay. And she's played Galinda and Elphaba, both of those. She's incredible.
Yeah.
And then it was all British cast beyond that. So, and like one of the gangsters was this guy named Mike Gibson, who's in the Star Wars movie. He played King George in Hamilton over there.
Yeah.
He's unreal. Just such a talented guy. And then that led to me doing a concert with the RTE Orchestra in Dublin with John Wilson.
Oh, okay.
And Jenna Russell and Damien Humbley, this amazing, and Kim Criswell. Like, so it's just, you know, you just try to cobble together things and not be a dick and do good work. It's just...
Right. Because I would almost say, like, even more... I don't know, even more, but certainly as important as the marketing, as the preparation for an audition, it's... being a nice guy, it's having good rapport with other people, them remembering you, and then they talk about you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so much who you know and who you've worked with.
Well, and how many times have you had, I know I've had a couple times where people are like, tell me about this person. What do you think? Yeah. And if the person asking me is a friend that I really want to direct, I'll be very honest about what I think.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I'm sure people are saying that about me too.
Yeah.
And look, you're not going to be friends with everybody, but you don't have to make enemies wherever you go.
Right. You can still be professional and show up, do your work, even if, you know, you're not buddy-buddy.
Yeah, with exactly. You know,
but that's how I got my first Muni gig. It was so strange because I had worked with the music director on the Addams Family tour. And so my agent just calls me up.
Who's that?
It was Val. Well,
I don't know.
Okay. I can't think of her last name. Yeah. Anyway, Valerie. I just know where's Val. I was on the Evita tour. And then my agent just says, I have a contract for you with the Muni. Did you audition for?
Like, amazing.
She didn't contact me. She did just all of a sudden.
That's
and
amazing.
I was like, well, yeah, I think I did the EPA. But yeah, so it was just a contract. And then come to find out, Val had just recommended me.
That's awesome.
They were looking for a Grinch. And here I am.
That's fantastic.
So, I mean, that was like the wildest thing.
Yeah.
So it really is about just being a person with other people.
That's it. And you know what? The times that I've been a dick, and God knows I have.
Been there, done that.
Usually it's when I'm feeling scared or insecure or whatever. And the times that I've seen the worst behavior from people is because of their fears. So
you just, when they're desperate.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that casting directors and directors will see in the room.
Yeah.
When we're like, I just want this. Please, please, please.
I was actually a reader for Kinky Boots in the auditions
for this?
On Broadway.
Oh, okay.
And it was so interesting. It's the first time I had done that. Only time I've done that. It was so interesting.
Yeah. What did you learn from that? Because I've been doing some reading myself.
well, first of all, is not to take anything. Like, I used to think, like, when I left an audition and they didn't bring somebody in right away, that was good. That means they're talking. That doesn't mean jack all. It really doesn't. So as much as you can, and everybody says it, but it's so hard to do, just leave the audition in the room and get on with your life. And then it's just about how you put yourself off, you know? It's like, when you come into the room, are you warm without being too eager? I mean, just be you and relaxed as you can and professional. Know your stuff. Be prepared so that the casting director knows that they can count on you and so that you can put your best self forward.
Yeah. The preparation, I think, was the biggest thing that I saw, because it was and it wasn't even about being memorized. It was just about knowing the material. Yeah, you have to look down, whatever.
Sure.
But it was about knowing the material, having a choice and a joy in doing it.
Yeah.
Whether you're being the bad guy or the, you know, ingenue. It's
yeah.
like about just having a joy and a drive
yeah.
to it. And that's something that that's not really something, I guess, that you practice. That's just something that exudes from you.
Well, and you also have to be aware of the room. Sometimes you'll go into a very congenial room and you can joke around and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Other times you'll go into a room and you just sense the energy.
Business.
Yeah. So then you be very polite, very charming and nice and warm and just go to the piano.
Yeah.
Do what you need to do and then go do your thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. As I've been doing more and more of the Broadway auditions, I'm noticing a bit more of that business atmosphere and a little less, hey, how you doing?
Yeah.
Pat on the back. Great. Yeah.
It's always different.
It varies, but it depends on the director.
It exactly does.
Yeah.
So, and it threw me. First time I auditioned for Trevor Nunn, you know, usually you go in there and you do your, hi, how are you doing? A little small talk. Go to the piano, you do that. First time I auditioned for Trevor, I go to the piano, I'm getting ready to do it. He goes, hey, come here, let's have a chat. So you have to go and have a talk with him beforehand. He wants you to sit down and talk with him. And a lot of British directors will do this. But it threw me off because I was like, no. This isn't how I do this.
I need to sing now.
I need to sing first. This is, I came in, I'm prepared. So you just kind of have to like relax and let it all come to you a little bit.
Yeah. What is your impression of being in the room and like knowing you did a good job or knowing you didn't? Having a sense of, oh, I think they like me. I think they don't. How do you feel?
I'm awful about it.
Yeah.
This the last TV thing I booked, I wrote my agent right afterwards. And I said, well, I thought I did well, but I have no expletive idea how to do this. I give up. She said when I texted her that, they had already called her and said, oh, he's pinned for this. And then I booked it. So I don't know. And I'm just going to stop thinking that I can even.
Yeah. That happened with me with an audition. I was like, okay, well, that I blocked that one. Okay. And then it turns out they put me on hold.
Yeah.
Because I was like, okay.
You well, then just I'll have just no wait. Idea.
I mean, I didn't end up getting it. Yeah. But still, I was down to me and whoever else. So
it's frustrating.
Yeah.
And so whatever. It's just the business.
Because so much of this is dependent upon other people. So it's nice whenever there are those moments when we can.
Yeah.
Do exactly. our own thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Ben, this has been such a pleasure.
Thanks, man. I hope it came off
okay. It's been good. It's been
cool.
Good.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. To find out more about Ben Davis and everything that we talked about today, go to the website, winmeetpodcast.com. There I'll have links where you can find him, follow him, and learn more about all of his work. Well, that does it for season two. We've reached the end. And again, I just want to thank you for joining not only me and Ben today, but myself and all of my guests this entire season. It's been such a joy to talk to them and bring those conversations to you. Over the summer, I'm going to be obviously taking a break. I have the rest of Kinky Boots to finish up, as well as I'll be doing Bridges of Madison County in North Carolina. A lot of work going on, which I'm so grateful and thankful for. And coming up in September, I hope to bring you a few new things. The blog will continue to go, so the blog will go on throughout the summer, so continue to keep up with that every Friday. And then coming up in September, I'll give you a hint. We had Jelani Aladdin on last year, and so someone else from the Frozen world will be joining me for the Season 3 opener. I hope you have a great summer. Keep up with me and the blog through Instagram and Twitter at WinMePodcast. I'm Patrick Oliver Jones, and it has been my joy to be your host this season, reminding you that the reasons for not making it may be countless and frustrating, but the reasons to keep going are even more numerous and rewarding. I'll see you in September.